What's a lousy $1 billion anyway?
$1 billion a year? Altogether, this aid package is not even one-tenth of what you gave AIG.
Pakistan's President Ali Asaf Zardari is possibly the first South Asian leader in the history of the world to compare his country to a nearly bankrupt insurance company. Will the argument get Pakistan more security aid? Playing the AIG card, 21st century diplomacy, only on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Save AIG, help Pakistan, billion here, billion there. Good morning. It's Monday, May 11th. I'm John Huckenberry, joined today by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. We're going to have a lot more on Pakistan and the Swat Valley with these thousands of refugees, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing. It's enormous. We're also going to ask, do you love a man in uniform talking to an author who married a military man, much to her surprise, and learned a lot about what it takes to be a military wife? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, the lawyer for Iranian-American journalist Roxana Sabiri says an Iranian appeals court has suspended her jail time on charges of espionage. He says she's expected to be released today. He also says the court banned her from working as a journalist in Iran for the next 5 years. Details of the evidence against her have still not been made public. The U.S. military says it documented 44 cases where Afghan militants have used the chemical white phosphorus as a weapon. It's conducting an investigation after charges that it was used in a recent battle that left dozens of civilians dead. This is a U.S. military investigation. Meanwhile, the U.S. military denies using white phosphorus itself. It's considered a war crime to use it as a weapon, Farai.
And in Pakistan, the government says it killed 200 militants around the Swat Valley in fighting over the weekend, but we don't have independent confirmation of those numbers. The UN says 360,000 refugees fled the region just in the past week. That's on top of 500,000 moved in past offensives. And Pope Benedict is in Israel today, and upon arrival at the airport, he said, let's have an independent Palestinian state. Not so controversial, right, John? That was irony right there. During his trip, he'll hold talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders and visit sites linked to the life of Jesus. And also, we're going to be talking more about Sri Lanka, where the violence in the north is intensifying. UN spokesman Gordon Weiss says there are 50,000 civilians trapped along with the LTTE, or the Tamil Tiger Rebels.
They have the LTTE bottled up in an area the size of New York Central Park. So it has been a matter of time, and it's for this exact reason that the UN has been warning of an impending bloodbath should something not give.
A government doctor says at least 430 civilians were killed over this weekend, including 100 children. And that, again, is hard to verify because reporters have been banned from the war zone.
So the Dow is up 2% on Friday to close at 85.75. The S&P finished trading at 929, where it begins today. President Obama tackles health care today. He plans to talk about an offer from the private sector to find $2 trillion in health care savings over the next 10 years to pay for health care reform. President is announcing that. Look at your budget. How would you bring down health care costs? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. It is a Monday morning, and that means just one thing.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
We call it the agenda here on The Takeaway, but it's also our Monday opportunity to visit with our friend Marcus Mabry, international business editor of The New York Times. Glad to have you back with us, Marcus.
Good to be here.
And right off the bat, the president, in his weekly radio address, outlined one huge consumer issue that's going to be on the agenda this week in Washington. And it's also expected at about noon today. Another one, the president will be announcing a voluntary $2 trillion of cost savings voluntarily from the healthcare industry as a way of beginning beginning debate on health care reform. And on Saturday, he mentioned this about credit cards.
Americans know that they have a responsibility to live within their means and pay what they owe. But they also have a right not to get ripped off by the sudden rate hikes, unfair penalties, and hidden fees that have become all too common in our credit card industry.
So, Marcus, leading with a credit card bill of rights and leading with voluntary industry cost savings on health care conceivably begins a very, very tough battle in Congress on two important consumer issues.
These are huge issues, John. You're right. And these are two issues we can expect to dominate this week. In some ways, it comes much closer to home than what we've seen in the last few weeks. We've seen lots of stuff about, kind of big fangled stuff in the finance industry and stress tests and saving banks. This hits Americans at home. These are two of our hugest costs for most of us. Healthcare for us and our families, which is, obviously employer healthcare programs where most of us get our healthcare are declining.
And more of us are being... costs are rising double of inflation. Healthcare inflation is double the national inflation rate.
Absolutely. And as we see more workers being thrown out of their jobs, and we can expect, even if the economy is bottoming out and expected to start going up now, we can still expect unemployment to go up, as much as a whole percentage point between now and next year. More and more Americans in that case find themselves out of work. And once their COBRA payments expire, then they find themselves usually uninsured. Mm-hmm. So this is a huge problem, and it's growing every day. That's obviously the heart of where we live. And then secondly, if you're talking about the credit card problem, that again, this is a problem millions of Americans are affected by, and the credit card industries are, this is kind of, I think, going to be the next big battle. This will be, a much bigger battle for the administration, actually, because the president has kind of prepackaged this deal with healthcare companies, but we're going to see, I think, a big battle with credit card companies.
How much of a battle is it, though? Is the economy possibly an opportunity because people are really paying attention to this issue? Does he have a real window here to push things forward in the way that the stimulus package went forward?
Well, this is two things. Number one, as Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, says, never waste a good crisis. That's always an opportunity, and that's how they see this. And then secondly, as a president, this is clearly not a president who's an underachiever. I mean, this guy, we're 107 days now, and this guy's talking about two of the hugest problems that we've dealt with for a long, long time, and he is not shy about confronting them all at once.
Well, it strikes me that one of the things that's happened in the United States is that people are changing their fundamental relationship to what it means to be a citizen. Do you agree that people were a bit more disengaged during the Bush era, and now with Obama particularly pushing huge changes in the banking and financial industries, that people may have more of an influence on public policy?
Well, it's interesting. I think that's part of it. I think also it's the fact that people also, most of that Bush administration time, as far as economics were concerned, most of us personally were doing okay, and things were getting better all the time, and it was a continuation of the Clinton era of prosperity, personally. Nothing focuses the mind like this crisis we're going through right now. And I think that's a lot of this kind of difference you're seeing in people's attitudes.
Another issue this week is Barack Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinner making a joke about Vice President Cheney, referring to interrogation techniques. Mm-hmm. And Vice President Cheney was on the talk shows all weekend long saying that perhaps we're less safe than we used to be. Here's the former vice president on CBS's Face the Nation.
When things are quieter 20 or 30 years from now, you'll be able to look back on this and say this is one of the great success stories of American intelligence. I think, in fact, what the men and women in the intelligence community and the lawyers in the Justice Department and the senior officials who approved this program did exactly the right thing.
That issue will be on the table when the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee holds a hearing what went wrong on Wednesday and Thursday this week. And among the issues are whether we're going to be perceived as safer or not. Vice President Cheney says we're less safe under the Obama administration, and the enhanced interrogation techniques, so-called, will be looked at by this subcommittee. Also, Nancy Pelosi, we learned last week she was briefed on this early on by the CIA. Is that going to dominate the debate this week?
It's interesting because the broader issues here are ones of safety. The Republicans, certainly the old guard, like the vice president, which is interesting about the vice president. We hear him so much more today than we ever did when he was vice president. It's extraordinary. They will emphasize this question of it's about being safe. The administration is talking about, well, what techniques are legal and what aren't. That's what it's trying to concentrate on, kind of the practical issues here. And the Democrats in Congress are trying to hold the Republicans' feet to the fire and saying, well, we need investigations here, which actually technically investigations could be a distraction. distraction from the administration getting it right as far as the policy goes. Nancy Pelosi's defense about the 2002 briefing was that this was about supposedly techniques that were going to be used in the future. And then secondly, she said that she was unaware, she was told that anything done would be legal. That's her defense, which ironically is much like Condoleezza Rice's defense.
Well, certainly the outline of the debate on national security is going to be seen at those hearings this week. Marcus Mabry, thanks so much for helping us to set the agenda of a very busy week in Washington. Marcus Mabry, of course, the international business editor for our partners, the New York Times. Brian?
Thanks, John. In Pakistan, thousands of people are fleeing the Swat Valley. The government is intensifying its fight against Taliban militants. These officials are struggling to deal with the refugee crisis. Now, tens of thousands of civilians took advantage of the lifting of a curfew in parts of the valley on Sunday to escape the fighting and join folks already in the refugee camps. Half a million were already there. For more, we spoke to BBC correspondent Mark Dummett, who's in Islamabad. And when we spoke earlier this morning, I asked Mark to give us the latest on the refugee crisis.
Yesterday, the army lifted a curfew which allowed about 100,000 people to flee the Swat Valley and move down to the south to lower ground, to safer ground. Now, some are being put up in camps, in tents, and the government and the UN and the Red Cross and others are looking after them. But most have moved in with families, with family members, with friends, or are renting accommodation. Basically, the feeling is that at the moment, things are okay. Enough aid is getting to these people, even though the numbers are huge. But if this crisis drags on for much longer, then things could become really unmanageable for the authorities.
Let me ask you a strategic question, Mark Dummett. It seems to me the intensity of this offensive against the Taliban suggests that why didn't Pakistan do this earlier? Why didn't Pakistan take this kind of step against Al-Qaeda 8 years ago? To do it now only begs the question, it seems to me, cries out to know where were they 8 years ago?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you're right in that the army and the government is saying now that, yes, they're fully committed to this fight and that they're doing all they can to deal a knockout blow to the Taliban in the Swat Valley. But I think the Pakistanis would also say that, you know, in 2003, 2004, they were also serious and they committed tens of thousands of troops to the border area with Afghanistan. And they have lost more men than the Americans, than the other NATO forces just over the border in Afghanistan. But, yes, I mean, they've been heavily criticized as well for their lack of commitment at times and also for their tactics. And again, the spotlight is on their tactics right now because they rely on aerial power. I mean, that's like the Americans and NATO in Afghanistan as well, and artillery. Civilians get caught up in that. Civilians are being killed. Houses are being destroyed. And that's really uncomfortable for the Pakistani government. It's one thing, you know, for Western governments, they can sort of ignore what the Afghans are saying about them. But it's very difficult for the Pakistani government. You know, when they're killing their own civilians, they're very, very unpopular.
Right. What about journalists? You know, in another crisis in Sri Lanka, we don't really have a hard sense of what's going on in terms of the numbers because journalists can't really get in. What about in Pakistan?
Well, yeah, I mean, the fighting has suddenly become so intensive that we don't really know what's going on in there because all the civilians who could flee have done so. And of course, that includes most of the journalists who are based up in Swat, the Pakistani journalists. I mean, foreign journalists have tried to get up there. I mean, a BBC team went up there. An Al Jazeera team went up there last week, and actually they were fired upon. Their correspondent was shot twice. I mean, they survived, but it's a warning. I mean, it's very, very dangerous. So no one's being blocked, but it is basically too dangerous.
Wow. That was BBC correspondent Mark Dummett, who reported from Islamabad in that interview conducted earlier this morning.
President says there's $2 trillion of health care savings. What would you save in the health care budget?
How would I reduce the cost of my health insurance? Would be by getting rid of insurance. One of the reasons why most of the health things that we do are so expensive causes inflation, I believe.
Give us a health care budget at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. One of the hot issues in politics has always been health care. You'll remember it became a fireball during the Clinton administration. And today, President Obama is going to announce $2 trillion in health care savings. The industry apparently is voluntarily going to deliver them over the next 10 years. Now, here's the question. If you were running the show, where would you start to bring down the cost of health care? Would you cut out end-of-life care, expensive operations, discretionary surgery? What's your take? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
$2 trillion in savings in 10 years. What would you save? Look at your own budget. Give us a call. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We got lots of information in this world. Some thoughts now on a world awash in information. There it is. The information all around us can be thought of as a kind of a blast of white noise. Featureless at first, but then as you wander around in it, you begin to hear things. Distinct? Meaningful? Continue to navigate, and suddenly there are some sounds you recognize. There we go. Yeah. Whoa. Hey, wait a minute. Am I on fire? If you're in a car right now and are hearing this, you might look around for an emergency vehicle, but you would be wrong. Figuring out how to respond to this siren noise coming out of your radio, coming out of the white noise analogy of our world awash in news and information, that couldn't be more connected to the headlines. Follow me here. Say that the information instead of a siren was the 20 or so unusual flu-like deaths in Mexico reported 2 weeks ago. Is that a siren off in the distance, or is it just around the corner? Or is it a sound effect coming out of your radio? Not relevant. Stephen Johnson joins us now to pick up the thread here. He wrote a book about an epidemic in a different era called The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed cities, science, and the modern world. He's also the founder of a website called Outside In, which aggregates hyper-local journalism from around the country. Stephen Johnson, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Hyper-local information is often a dangerous thing. Compare this sort of signal-to-noise problem with the kind of overwhelming reaction to the swine flu reports that came out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is crucial to understand what happened with swine flu is that you see both the kind of the incredible benefits of this connected information age and then the downside of it, that we have this ability now to detect a pattern in deaths in Mexico City, that these were, you know, unusually healthy people who were dying, although there were just 20 of them. And that news then gets broadcast around the world to the people who need to know about it, the Centers for Disease Control and health organizations all around the world, so that they can track it. So we have this enormous asset and the ability to jump on something like this and start looking for it and detecting the pattern of its transmission. The other side of it, though, of course, is that we all hear about it as well. I mean, and so suddenly what is still a very early, you know, affair, I mean, you know, an early kind of breaking kind of epidemic becomes this global media event. And it necessarily ends up terrifying us more than probably it needs to at that stage.
But it appears as though news consumers prefer to navigate the raw white noise of information. They would rather feel as though they're getting an advance notice on things. And I remember working in television, the editors and the sort of managing editors at the cable news places that I worked at always wanted breaking news.
Yeah.
Everything is breaking news. Always. There's a hot story of the day, whether there was any news or not. So it seems as though people feel more comforted by getting this alarmist headline and navigating it on themselves. They don't want the context.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder if they feel more comforted or if they're just drawn inexorably to it, right? I mean, if there's a sense of we have all these things in society where we have a disproportionate sense of the actual threat posed by this particular thing because the headlines gravitate towards these kinds of stories. So child abductions, for instance, which are statistically very, very rare, and it's really one of the last things you should worry about with your kids, or many more threats that are immediately dangerous to them. Car accidents, for instance, much
right.
more of a threat. But we don't have national headlines about car accidents, but we do about child abductions because, ironically, because they're unusual. and because they're so dramatic. And so we're drawn to those things because they are unusual and dramatic. But they instill in us a sense of kind of a wrong sense of where the actual threats are.
So this is what newspapers say they need to do here, that they're declining, but there's a need for this context more than ever before. Why the decline?
That's the classic kind of gatekeeper's argument, right? And it would be better, we're better off to have people who are able to provide this kind of responsible, contextual case on things. But even with something like swine flu, I mean, the Daily News had this headline, you know, from 2 weeks ago saying, you know, the swine flu spreading like wildfire through the city. When in fact, it was pretty much just spreading like the flu. It wasn't spreading in a particularly unusual way. And there had been, you know, no severe cases in the entire city. So I don't know. That is certainly the argument that the big papers should be providing that kind of context. But they don't necessarily always do it.
You know, there's a term, smart mobs, for, you know, people who come together and, you know, crowdsourcing, whether it's online or face-to-face. Is this kind of, you know, dumb mobs?
Right. Yeah, it could well be. And there's a history to this. I mean, in some ways, the book that you alluded to, The Ghost Map, this cholera outbreak in London, was also really a story about information and about kind of mobs kind of coming together, ordinary people on the street helping to solve this mystery, this outbreak. And information was crucial to that story as well, and you had to kind of detect this pattern in the outbreak and where people were dying in London. And being able to use that information and use it wisely is absolutely essential, and our ability to kind of master more and more information and detect more and more subtle patterns in all that data, we're getting better and better at that, which is great, and that may be the single biggest asset we have against future pandemics when they come along.
Well, but let's talk about just general information flow. And you're someone who lives off the free flow of information that is causing problems for newspapers and books. Yeah. Why is it that headlines and small blurbs are favored on cell phone platforms? It's hard to carry a book around compared with looking at just like the Google News page.
Right.
What's going to change that?
Well, I think what we're seeing actually is some interesting stuff is starting to happen with social services like Twitter, for instance. Whereas Twitter, which we know is the ultimate kind of short messaging system,
yeah,
140 characters, right? But what people are now using it for increasingly is to send links around, right? So it's not just this is what I had for breakfast, but it's here's this really interesting longer story that I read. And it's becoming a major kind of driver of traffic to those longer stories. In fact, I used it all the time on book tour for my last book. So I'm using 140 characters to promote 70,000 words. And so I think we're getting, yes, headlines do flow through that, but people click on those headlines to read the longer articles.
Very quickly, the Kindle was announced as a possible platform for newspapers. Google's putting books in its archive. Is there any future there for long-form contextualized text files like books and newspapers?
There's an incredible data that Amazon has announced about how many people are buying books on the Kindle. I mean, they're seeing far more books purchased per consumer if you have a Kindle. So I think long format reading may be back in style.
Hopeful news out of the white noise of information. Stephen Johnson's latest book is The Invention of Air. He's also the author of The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks a lot.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we have Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much. At 32 minutes past the hour, on Capitol Hill today, the president plans to announce an offer from the private sector to spend $2 trillion to help pay for his health care overhaul, and that money would come in over the next 10 years. The Justice Department is expected to restore an aggressive antitrust enforcement policy today that would reverse the Bush administration's approach, which strongly favored businesses in antitrust suits. The lawyer for American-Iranian journalist Roxana Saberi says that she will be freed from Iranian jail later today. It's not yet been confirmed by the Iranian government. Saberi's lawyer says that the court has reduced her 8-year prison sentence to a suspended 2-year sentence. Saberi was convicted of spying for the US in April, but denies the charge. Pope Benedict is in Israel today on the most delicate stage of his trip to the Middle East. The Pope will be holding talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. But one Israeli resident is more concerned with a more practical aspect of the Pope's visit.
For me, it's just a traffic problem today. I don't think about him like a god or something else. That's a traffic problem.
Just a traffic problem. The Pope's trip includes visits to... I know how she feels.
It's very typical.
Pope Benedict XVI is in town and I just can't get around in my car. So the Pope's visit actually includes trips to sacred sites connected to the life of Jesus and also a trip to the Holocaust Memorial in Israel. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
So, again, like you said, the Pope is visiting Israel today, but there's also a lot going on in the region. For more, I spoke with the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. King Abdullah of Jordan says the U.S. is putting final touches to a diplomatic plan. It's going to offer comprehensive peace in the Middle East. In our interview conducted earlier this morning, I asked Jonathan to explain what's going on.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it looks to be based on the principle that if you can't solve one problem in isolation, make the problem bigger, bring in all the problems and try and resolve them all at once. King Abdullah, in an extensive interview with the Times newspaper of London, is really setting out the thinking behind what he sees as what's going on in Washington, an emphasis on trying to achieve a comprehensive peace deal in the Middle East, not just a settlement for the Palestinians, but peace between Israel and Syria, between Israel and Lebanon too, but broader than that even, what King Abdullah calls a 57-state solution, basically peace between Israel and the whole of the Arab and Muslim world.
That's quite ambitious, as you say. And also, you know, there's a bosunch of other talks coming up. You've got Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president, talking to, you know, just today to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, and they're going to meet with President Obama in days. What's going on with that?
Well, this is all part and parcel, one supposes, of the elements that will go towards the unfolding of this wider plan. You're quite right. Prime Minister Netanyahu in Egypt today, in Washington next week. Obviously, another key date will be early June when President Obama is due to give this keynote speech in Cairo, and it's suggested he may set out some of his thinking during that speech. Of course, I think many analysts will be wondering. I mean, it is a hugely ambitious and brave thing to do. America, in fact, there hasn't been, not just America, there hasn't been this kind of comprehensive diplomacy for almost 20 years now. You have to go back to the Madrid talks in 1991. But clearly, there seems to be a lot of diplomatic movement in the undergrowth, if you like. And the stakes are very high. King Abdullah himself warning that if there is not some significant step towards a comprehensive peace, then there could be renewed conflict in the region within as short a period as 12 to 18 months.
Well, Jonathan, you say brave, but I'm wondering if ridiculous could possibly come to mind. The Obama administration has signaled fairly clearly that it is interested as King Abdullah is in these final status issues, using them as a kind of a framework for talks. Can the Israeli domestic political scene absorb that kind of a ambitious agenda here? We've already got a fairly fragile government in Israel. It's a narrow right-wing coalition, and the point man who was announced as the person who's responsible for the U.S. Israel relationship is significantly opposed to a two-state solution.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that's 100% correct. I think the difficulty is this. Clearly, this is not an Israeli government that believes that there are any significant openings towards peace anytime soon. So it's retrenching. It's trying to take the safe option to manage things. And now, I suppose there are many people who might argue that given real opportunities on the peace front, that government perhaps might collapse under the weight of its own internal contradictions. It clearly is a rather stranger coalition that is in place in in Israel. I think the difficulty, though, is that you can see in isolation how you would bring about peace between Israel and the key Arab states. The much greater problem is how you are going to bring in the non-state actors, Hamas, Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah may well emerge from the coming Lebanese elections in a much stronger position. What about Iran's role in the region, that sort of looming presence over the whole thing from a little further away? So I think that is the difficulty, that a comprehensive deal in any reasonable time frame is going to be incredibly difficult to achieve. I suppose the optimists would say that in the absence of such an attempt at a deal, then King Abdullah might well be right. There might be a return to armed conflict, and therefore that you actually cannot take the risk of doing nothing. But I think if this is the direction the Obama administration is going in, then it is an immensely bold and brave, and you're right, some people might say a foolhardy approach, but it certainly looks as though he's going to be breaking the mold, if you like, of Middle Eastern diplomacy in the coming weeks.
Jonathan, just quickly, we see these continual flashpoints in the Middle East, you know, Gaza on. What really is the flashpoint right now? When, you know, it strikes me that when King Abdullah says that, you know, there could be war, what's the big flashpoint we're looking at?
Well, the big flashpoints, I think, involve those two non-state actors, if you want to call them that. I mean, clearly, in the Gaza Strip, whilst there is a relative lull at the moment between Israel and Hamas, very little has been resolved in the wake of Israel's operations in the Gaza Strip. There is no lasting ceasefire. There are no better arrangements for bringing supplies and power and so on to the people inside the Gaza Strip. So that is a huge looming problem. The other possibility, of course, is renewed conflict across Israel's border with Lebanon involving Hezbollah.
That was BBC correspondent Jonathan Marcus, who reported to us on the diplomatic road to peace in the Middle East in that interview from earlier. John?
A brave plan or a ridiculous plan? We will definitely find out. The President Obama is announcing a $2 trillion health care savings plan that the industry is apparently going to deliver over the next 10 years. Well, if they can find $2 trillion in cuts, where would you look to bring down your health care costs?
Don't fool yourselves. If you want to pay less for health care, you'll have to look at other countries that do pay less. Look closely and realize they pay for less health care than we receive, and particularly at the extremes of life, particularly at the end of life.
Your story of health care cost reductions at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Of course, the other big story in the Middle East is the Pope's visit, Pope Benedict XVI, who is continuing his tour of the Middle East, landing in Israel today. Yesterday in the town of Bethany in Jordan, he spoke about his mission for this trip to the Holy Land.
Christians are called to offer their contribution, inspired by the example of Jesus, of reconciliation and peace through forgiveness and generosity.
The Vatican is calling this visit a pilgrimage of peace. For more insight on the clout the Vatican has in the Holy Lands, we spoke with longtime follower of the Vatican, BBC Rome correspondent David Willey. The first thing I wanted to know when I spoke to David was simply, how is the Pope's trip going so far?
Jordan's leg of the journey is complete. As he left Jordan, the Pope said that he was one of the most memorable events so far was his visit to a mosque. But now the scene has changed radically. He's here in Israel. He's been welcomed by Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he is on Israeli territory, and he'll be visiting holy sites both in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. But he didn't waste any time at the airport at the welcome ceremony. He issued a terrifically strong condemnation of anti-Semitism in any form. He said anti-Semitism continues to rear its ugly head in many parts of the world, and this is totally unacceptable. So many Israelis, I think, were hoping that the Pope would say something like this, and they must have been pleased. However, he did not in any way apologize specifically for His remarks, which have caused some offence in some Jewish circles, over reconciliation with a Holocaust-denying Roman Catholic bishop. The Pope feels he's already said enough on this matter. He has made it clear that he feels that the discussion on this matter is now at an end, and he wants to move ahead. But whether that'll be the line taken here in Israel remains to be seen. The other interesting thing was that the Pope launched immediately into potential controversy over the question of a Palestinian homeland. He said, which has been Vatican policy for many, many decades now, that he wants to help the peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, and the Palestinians do have a right to a homeland of their own with secure and internationally recognized borders. So this is slightly embarrassing for the Israeli authorities in that the Prime Minister has not yet made entirely clear whether he favors a two-state solution.
You know, we've seen in the visits by the Vatican to Israel and to this region a sense of sort of making up for past issues of controversy, mostly related from the World War II period, and you've alluded to some there. At what point does the Vatican take more of a role as an actual active mediator? It seems to me that once this historical baggage is taken care of, there might be a role for the Vatican. Do you see that as a possibility?
I think that the Pope would like to go down in history as a peacemaker in the Middle East. He would like that. However, the Vatican does make it very clear that the Pope is not in the business of active politics. You can't see him sitting down at a peace table with Israelis and Palestinians. It's the spiritual support which is important for him.
Symbolism will have to do for now. That was BBC Rome correspondent David Willey in an interview conducted earlier today about the Pope's visit to the Holy Land. He's in Israel today.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. How do you find healthcare cost savings? Anne emailed us to say it used to be the Hippocratic Oath was the model of healthcare. First, do no harm. No longer. Americans are overprescribed pharmaceuticals with side effects and invasive procedures. We need to focus on alternatives like educating families on healthy diets and alternative treatments like acupuncture, herbs, chiropractic, and homeopathy. We will cut healthcare costs by treating healthcare policy that focuses on healthy choices, prevention, and less costly therapy. Will that get you to $2 trillion like the Obama administration is going to talk about later today? Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Femi Okeh has some headlines now.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The lawyer for the Iranian-American journalist Roxana Saberi says that an Iranian appeal court has suspended her jail time on charges of espionage. Her lawyer says that she's expected to be released today. The Iranian government has not yet confirmed that, but Ms. Saberi's father, Reza Saberi, says he expects to see his daughter soon.
I was told about half an hour ago that she will be free as of today. So practically, she is free as of now.
The court has banned Saberi from working as a journalist in Iran for the next 5 years. The head of the U.S. military says that he's appointed a brigadier general to investigate U.S. use of airstrikes in Afghanistan. General Petraeus says that the coalition airstrikes that killed dozens of civilians last week were in response to Taliban attacks. The general argues that the Taliban launched attacks from civilian homes. In Pakistan, the government says that it has killed 200 militants around the Swat Valley in fighting over the weekend. However, we have no independent confirmation of these numbers, and the United Nations says that 360,000 refugees have fled the region in the last week. And that's a look at some of the big stories making headlines today.
Thanks, Femi. And coming up, we have a guest who really has seen quite a bit of military life. She says, I wasn't a war bride. I was a war on terror bride. Her name is Lily Barana. She's written about everything from sexuality, stripping her way across the country to cowboy culture. And after 9/11, she married her boyfriend, who was a military officer with top secret clearance. In her latest memoir, I Love a Man in Uniform, she gives us a sense of her own journey as a military wife and the insider's world of military wives. First off, Lily, you know, tell me about your husband and the marriage you describe in your book.
We had met in 2000, became friends, and started dating in 2001. And as our relationship intensified, the jungle drums of war started beating. And in November of 2002, he said to me, I really think this war is going to happen. And if it does happen, I want to make sure you're taken care of. So we went off to Baltimore City Hall and got married. And immediately thereafter, we put together the deployment binder that every military couple has. And I've had my marriage license put right next to his will.
So war actually caused you to take the vows?
Absolutely true.
You know, there has been an incredible recognition of the stress that's on military marriages. And in 2007, more than 13,000 military marriages failed. You guys have been through some tough times, but you're still together. Tell us one of the toughest moments, you know, that you faced in being a military wife. And I'll get more to the military wife culture in a second. Mm-hmm. What really struck you as the most wrenching?
I would say the most wrenching thing for me, the first up in a sequence of many, it was quite a batting order we had, was the roller coaster ride of deployment. Now, you go to the family readiness group pre-deployment briefing where they tell you what you can reasonably expect, which is there are days as the wife where you're going to be angry for no reason, and there are days where you're going to be despondent, and then there are going to be days where you feel like you're single all over again. And I went through all those things and more. I got to the point where I was so eager to hear from him that I would not use the bathroom without the cell phone by my side.
Hmm. Then and you could hear from him at any moment because the technology is everywhere on the battlefield.
That's right. And this is we were sort of a couple that a lot of military couples are making history because we are the first generation of military marriages to be in constant contact while the spouse is in theater.
Let's get to military wife culture. There was a book in the 1940s, I believe, called The Army Wife that you reference. Are you a good Army wife?
One of the things that has been so striking to me in having written this book, which is really getting behind the perfect Army wife game face, is how many military wives have written to me from all over the country and, you know, points abroad as well, saying, I struggle with this role too. We have this sort of overarching Stepfordian image of a perfect cake-baking, husband-loving, kid-raising, flag-waving, country-loving wife. And there are times when we just falter because it is a stressful time to be in a military marriage, and it is a stressful time to be a conscientious American when you're looking at things like the torture memos coming out and all sorts of stuff. So what's been rewarding to me is hearing lots of wives saying, you know what, this is stressful for me too, and I'm grateful to do the job, but it's not easy.
So the image of a military wife is just as flawed as the image of the straightforward, unquestioning, gung-ho soldier. It's no more correct than that myth.
That is true.
One of the amazing things about this book, though, and you're not an ordinary military wife in any sense whatsoever. I mean, if you read this book, I Love a Man in a Uniform, you will be taken to places which I think it's fair to say have never appeared before in memoir literature or anything. You've got the story of your, you know, life as a stripper long before you met your husband, which you allude to in here, which you also have written a book about. But there's a scene in this book where you take your husband to a strip club to kind of show him the territory. And then there's also a scene of you deciding not to go caroling at West Point on the first sort of year you were there because you were too self-conscious about mixing with the other military lives. I mean, that's an amazing study in contrast. What a whipsaw you went through.
Well, I really wanted to bring that to people because civilian curiosity about the military and the military family is at an all-time high. So I was like, you know what? I surveyed about 40 of my civilian girlfriends, and I said, if you could ask a military wife anything, knowing the specifics of my life and my background in exotic dance and then becoming a journalist, be shameless. And this question, this book basically answers that entire questionnaire. It was probably about 50 nosy questions that I'm happy to share with the American public.
Apparently you are, yes.
Well, you know, one of the things along those lines about your history is that you posed for Playboy once, and you say, who knew that getting into the Army system and getting into Playboy had anything in common? What did you mean by that?
Well, you're sort of run through a grid in both instances. And one of the things that was surprising to me when you become a military spouse is the ritual of getting your spouse ID card. And I sat down at the little webcam to get my picture taken, and you need this ID to get your health care and to get into the commissary and to get on post. They actually scan your ID with a little scanner when you pull up to the gate. And my husband said, she's here to get her dependent ID card. And the woman behind the counter was like, oh, no, 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 no. We don't call them dependents anymore because of a spousal rebellion. Women do not like to, in the military context, be referred to as dependent any longer. So, again, it's not necessarily who military wives are not necessarily who you think in terms of being, quote unquote, dependent. They reject that title quite vociferously, as do I.
So in addition to being in war, your husband was also posted to West Point, which is what you talk about. And with this book publication, one officer canceled your reading at the campus bookstore, but I understand a professor has invited you to speak, or you've spoken to a class?
Correct.
So how does it feel to be rejected and accepted?
Well, it's always strange to get a rejection and an acceptance from the same place in the same day. But, you know, a lot of cadets, particularly female cadets, came forward and they said, you know, I'm not okay with this. It's actually, I'm not okay with you being canceled from your appearance at West Point because this makes me doubt my decision to be part of the Army if this is what they're going to do to people who represent viewpoints that they, and I put this in air quotes on air, don't consider appropriate.
Well, you know, Lily Barana, thanks so much for this. And, you know, I think that this issue is going to continue to really bubble. Just give me quickly one question that your girlfriends asked you to answer.
What are the other wives like? And I was happy to tell them when I moved on to West Point. I had a vegetarian wife on one side of me and an avid bow hunter on the left.
It makes for some strange potlucks, author Lily Barana of I Love a Man in Uniform. Thanks very much.
I want to hear more about the bow hunter, but you can see that interview on a video on our website, thetakeaway.org. And also, there are some special web-only questions there that we didn't get to on the radio show. President is announcing a $2 trillion health care savings plan that the industry is going to voluntarily fork over the next 10 years. How are you taking care of your own health care costs?
My name is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. And over the last 2 years, I've lost 75 pounds, and we're taking charge of our own health. And we've found that there are much fewer visits to the doctor. We're being more efficient with our own health care. I think it's time Americans stepped up and took responsibility of their own bodies.
Slim down, literally and fiscally. 877-8-MY-TAKE to talk about health care costs. The president will be announcing at 12:30 a $2 trillion savings program as the health care reform debate begins again in Washington. You can also go to thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
Our ability to kind of master more and more information and detect more and more subtle patterns in all that data, we're getting better and better at that, which is great. And that may be the single biggest asset we have against future pandemics when they come along.
Finding information in the noise of white noise of ubiquitous information in the information age. Stephen Johnson, author of The Ghost Map.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, let's do lunch. Huh? Who does lunch anymore?
Welcome to the Toaster Oven Chef, the show where we make fast, easy, gourmet meals in the toaster oven for under $5.
Hey, if you can put a toaster oven on your desk, you might have a solution to the daily lunch crisis in cash-strapped times. Developing a strategy to dine at your desk. The workstation pantry, the laptop cuisine, your guide to dining, El Desco. Hint, stay away from bouillabaisse. Tips to live by on The Takeaway.
all across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Desk Cuisine, good morning. It's Monday, May 11th. I'm John Huckenberry, joined today by Farai Chidea, who has quite a desk cuisine of her own. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, I brought in a whole weird egg thing this morning. Anyway, protein. Coming up this morning, we are going to speak with one of the main Republicans who voted to legalize same-sex marriage. We're going to talk about the president's latest move on health care. Are the industry folks going to play nice in this $2 trillion plan? And it's been 20 years since Russia pulled out from Afghanistan. We're going to speak with the son of former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev about parallels between now and then. Those stories coming up, but first the headlines.
I think your next book should be titled Whole Weird Egg Thing.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I like that. That was good. And in the headlines this morning, the lawyer for Iranian-American journalist Roxana Sabiri says her sentence has been suspended after a decision from an appeals court and that she'll be released today. The Iranian government has not confirmed that. She had been convicted on charges of espionage. Roxana Sabiri may be moving to more comfortable quarters, but Pakistan is trying to figure out how to house some 360,000 displaced refugees. They're fleeing fighting in the Swat Valley, where the Pakistani government says it killed 200 militants this weekend. Fry?
Speaking of homes, nearly 30,000 people in Santa Barbara, California are going back to theirs. That's after the wildfires have been 65% contained. Joe Waterman of the California Fire Incident Command Team says investigators think they know the cause.
The fire cause appears to be related to the use of power tool equipment involved in vegetation clearance.
That comes after some Santa Barbara residents received notices saying they needed to clear away brush, so officials wouldn't say if anyone faced charges. And in Sri Lanka, a government doctor says at least 430 ethnic Tamil civilians are dead after 2 days of shelling across the northern war zone there. The ICRC information officer in Colombo, Sarasi Wijerutna, says the aid group is struggling to get enough relief supplies into the region.
Food and some medicines have actually been going into the conflict areas, but this is insufficient to meet the basic needs of the people.
And 50,000 other civilians are thought to be trapped with the Tamil Tigers in the war zone, which is about the size of New York Central Park. The claims are impossible to verify because reporters are banned from the war zone.
Two other quick headlines. Pope Benedict is in Israel today. The space shuttle Atlantis is fueling for the last mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. The Dow opens at 85.75 and the S&P opens at 9.29. Todd Zwillick in a moment is going to tell us all about the latest initiative from the Barack Obama administration, finding $2 trillion of health care savings from industry cutbacks. What would you do to bring down the cost of health care? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and last week, Maine became the fifth state where same-sex marriage is legal. Maine's Democratic-controlled Senate voted 21-13 in support of the bill. It redefines marriage as the legal union of two people, not just between a man and a woman. The state's House of Representatives debated the issue hotly for 3 hours and then voted 89-57 in favor. Seven Republican representatives voted in favor of the bill, and one is Maine Representative Pat Flood, who's with us now. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So first off, let's know a little bit about you. Do you consider yourself not only a Republican, but a conservative?
A fiscal conservative. I think if you characterize me as a conservative Republican, that would bring some chuckles from some of my colleagues. I think I'm probably better characterized as a moderate, somewhat independent Republican.
So before this whole debate, where did you stand on same-sex marriage?
Kind of neutral. I really wasn't a topic that I spent a lot of time thinking about. I serve on the state's budget committee, so I'm pretty well focused on that kind of thing all the time. So pretty neutral, and frankly, like a lot of legislators, I almost would rather not have to deal with it. But the fact of the matter is it comes to us, and we have to deal with it.
Now, when you take a look at issues like this, which are huge hot-button issues, do you rely on your internal compass, or do you talk to your constituents and rely on what they want, or both?
It's a balance of all that. For I had about 600 constituent inquiries on the topic beforehand, and generally more favorable than unfavorable. And I spent a lot of time actually talking to my family and colleagues and coworkers and so forth. And then, you know, when it comes right down to it, that's why they elect us, is to make difficult decisions, and you think it through yourself. And I spent quite a bit of time the 2 weeks up to that vote thinking that through, and came to some conclusions that helped me get to my vote.
A state representative who doesn't approach things with a preconceived notion, who actually listens to people close to them and constituents and voters in the state and makes a decision, what's wrong with you? My goodness.
I think, you know, Maine is a pretty tolerant and wonderful place to live, where I think people express their views independently and openly, and I think that elected officials over time up this way have mirrored that.
Now, New England has been, you know, one of the epicenters of the response to the calls for same-sex marriage. Why do you think that is?
Again, I think it's that independent nature of New England, perhaps.
Finally, give us a sense of where you think this will change Maine. Do you think it's going to change Maine a lot, a little? How does this really figure into your state?
You know, that part I hadn't really thought through that much, but to me, I guess it wasn't really so much about my traditions or my values or opinions voiced by others, but the whole discussion on gay marriage was really about gay people who would like the freedom to get married. And the fact is, like it or not, they had to get permission from other people, like legislators and a governor, before they could do that. And I think now that that's done, I think it expresses to all the country that Maine is a state that recognizes equal freedoms and encourages tolerance and the celebration of our differences. So I think that will be a good thing overall for Maine.
All right, Representative Pat Flood, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now we want to broaden this issue out a bit. Same-sex marriage laws have swept through New England in particular. New Hampshire's weighing in on the issue. D.C. also got in the mix voting last week to recognize same-sex marriages that were performed in other parts of the U.S. Now, President Obama has said he doesn't see a need for federal same-sex marriage laws, but the question is, could it happen anyway? We've got Suzanne Goldberg. She's a professor at Columbia Law School and director of the Gender and Sexuality Law Program. Suzanne, there seems to be some momentum here now. Is this national momentum or just a couple of states?
Well, I think there's extraordinary momentum right now, whether we call it, and it certainly is national in the sense that the entire country, I think, is paying attention to these issues, that the entire country, I think, is seeing that, like it or not, things are changing in this area, and that, in fact, for many, many people and for increasing majorities of younger people, whether gay people marry or not is really the significance of it is most people think that gay couples should be able to marry, especially in the younger demographic. They just don't get the big deal.
Do you really have statistics that say most people think that gay people should be allowed to marry, not just have civil unions?
I think that the trend is in that direction. Certainly, if you polled every person in the if you polled people across age groups, the results are more mixed, but the trend is clear, and certainly among the younger demographic is quite clear. And I think the point really is that for most younger people, the differences between gay and straight and bisexual are just benign variation, right? There certainly are differences, but they're not differences that are interesting or most younger people think, or certainly not differences that should be the basis for discrimination. We've seen that change in the way that people look at employment, and now we're seeing that change in the way that people look at marriage.
Suzanne, but we're also seeing a certain amount of dissonance here. I mean, in California, when people were asked in a voting booth to make the exact same decision, whether they thought it was a big deal or not, or whether it was something that actually inspired the fire in their blood, you know, they voted against having a legal opportunity in California for same-sex couples to get married. So the question is how it's asked as much as whether anecdotally people are feeling that this isn't a big deal or that gay couples should be allowed to express their own sort of freedoms.
I certainly agree with you. The question is very much in how it's asked and then in all of the media messaging that goes around, however the question is asked. If people believe that they are being asked, will my religion have to change if the state marries gay couples, that does arouse a set of questions, of fear, of anxiety among many, many people. If the question is asked in a way that makes clear that religious communities will continue to do whatever they choose to do without interference of the state, and that the marriage that is put, say, on the ballot in California or is being debated by legislatures is purely civil marriage, that is the way in which the state recognizes relationships, you get a different set of answers. Because when you think about it, when states are offering marriage and civil union, what they're really doing is recreating an existing bureaucracy, saying we have a bureaucracy of marriage, but now we're going to create the same thing for a different set of people. And when we think about that and people's concerns about government waste, among other things, that leads the analysis down a different road.
Suzanne, what about portability? You know, it's a big question. If you get married in Maine as a lesbian or gay couple, you can go to Tennessee and your marriage may not be recognized. Is portability going to become an issue?
Portability is already an issue and will continue to be an issue for as long as we have this patchwork of states, some that recognize marriages of same-sex couples and some that don't. And it's a very, very serious problem. We have seen and heard many tragic stories, including of people being excluded from hospital rooms, certainly on a less dramatic scale, but still very difficult for the individual couples involved. People just trying to figure out the morass of different laws that apply to them where they are. But essentially, it's right, most married couples travel across the country and feel comfortable knowing that their marriage stays with them as they cross state borders. And that is just not the case for same-sex couples today.
Well, thanks so much. We have been talking with Suzanne Goldberg, professor of law at Columbia Law School.
Possible freedom for Iranian-American journalist Roxana Saberi, who was convicted in Iran last month of spying for the United States. Joining us now is New York Times reporter in Tehran, Nazila Fati. Nazila, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Now, the wires are reporting that her lawyer says she's been freed or is expected to be freed today, and that the court on appeal has actually reversed her conviction. What are you learning?
Yes, I learned from the lawyer about 20 minutes ago that they are expecting her to be released any minute. Her two lawyers, along with her parents and many other journalists, are waiting outside the prison, and she could be released any time. It's late in the afternoon now, so she's definitely going to be released because they've been informed that she would be.
And according to the reports we have, her jail term was reduced for spying from 8 years to a suspended 2-year sentence, which means she can be released, and that she will be prohibited from being a journalist in Iran for the next 5 years. This is a strong message to her, which I'm sure will be welcomed, but it's also an interesting message to the U.S. government, don't you think?
First of all, it shows that the charges against her were not valid. According to her lawyer, the lawyer said that on Sunday they argued that the two countries were not at war, so spying charges were not valid. And that's how the earlier sentence was reduced.
Well, that's
The fact that she's released, I think, is a big step, and it shows that Iran is welcoming overture from the United States.
In a small sense and in a big sense, a welcome step. Nazila Fati, New York Times reporter in Iran, talking about the impending release of Roxana Saberi. Thank you very much, Nazila.
You're welcome.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farah Jadea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. If you could find $2 trillion of health care savings from looking at health care costs in your health care experience, what would you look for?
I think the best way to make cutbacks on health care in the budget is to stop prolonging life beyond its dignity and letting people go and die in peace.
Reducing costs at the end of life. That's Jane from Rhode Island, who called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The president is expected to announce this $2 trillion of cost savings and a big tent coalition as the health care reform debate gets started of industry leaders and public sector policymakers, drug makers, hospitals, insurance companies, all agreed to play nice in Washington as the healthcare debate begins once again in Washington. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, now joins us from D.C. He's a veteran in covering healthcare debates in the past. And now this is a real twist, Todd. Maybe it's too good to be true.
It might be too good to be true. It could be too good to be true. But the problem is we won't have any way of really knowing if it's too good to be true because this is a voluntary effort, John. There's really no way to enforce it except to use the power of the presidency to make people feel bad if they don't. This is not under federal rules. This is not under federal law yet. So all of these players, like you mentioned, and they're the big, heavy lobbying hitters coming here, are trying. It looks like they're trying to get on the winning team. It looks like there's so much political muscle behind health reform this year. There's a broad cross-section of everyone in politics who knows the system is a mess and has to be reformed, that nakedly trying to kill it, just like they did in 93-94 under Bill Clinton, and these, by the way, are many of the same groups that killed it the last time.
Interesting.
Just killing it is probably not an option this time. Better to be on the winning team. That seems to be what they're doing here.
Well, two alarming implications, and again, $2 trillion over the next 10 years. That's according to the reports. We'll see what President Obama says at 12:30 today. But are they motivated by fear? And if they are or not, why didn't they come up with these cost savings, 5 years ago, 10 years
ago? Well, that's a great question, and a lot of what they're volunteering to do is stuff that they probably that has been debated for many, many years, John. They could have done 10 years ago, but if they're going to do it now, that's great. So there's a couple of things they're saying they can do. The insurance companies say we can streamline administrative costs, forms, overhead, administration. The private insurance industry has administration costs that are much, much higher than even Medicare. The federally run health program for elderly and disabled people. Their overhead is about twice as high as what Medicare is. So they say we can cut that. We can cut duplication of forms, a lot of things to make that cheaper. We can promote prevention, primary care, wellness, weight loss, all of these things that keep people healthier on the front end. You were just talking about care on the back end at the end of life. Well, most of the money really is in prevention. Prevent diabetes, heart disease in the first place. No smoking, less overweight people. That can go a long, long way. Insurance companies say we can save the system billions, hundreds of billions by doing that. They can do things like instead of paying for every little test, every little treatment you get in the hospital, pay for the entire episode of care. Somebody comes in with a heart attack, instead of paying for every little medication, every little test, every little treatment, and then all the follow-up care, say, we'll pay you one set amount for this patient's disease.
A flat and rate for the visit.
Care.
A flat rate.
That's right.
You got a heart attack, there's a price for that.
There's a heart attack for the whole episode of care that may last six months.
I got you.
Then the hospital and the doctor and the insurance company is motivated to keep you better longer because they're not going to get paid for every little single test. So your question was, why didn't they do this 10 years ago? Because nobody forced them. And when they killed health care back in 93-94, they bought themselves another 13 years of the current system that we have. Well, that seems to be coming to an end. I think all these powerful lobbyists and very intelligent people in these industries, you're talking about pharma, the drug industry, the Association of Health Plans, the insurance industry, the AMA, the American Hospital Association, all the heavy hitters. I think they realize that being just against it's not an option.
We shall see.
Todd, the catchphrase, the political third rail here is the phrase socialized medicine. And people compare us often to Canada, which does have, overall cost savings. But some Canadians come here to get treatments they can't get in Canada. At the same time, you had Americans buying drugs from Canada because they couldn't have their insurance pay for the drugs. It's been kind of a comparison. What about this whole specter, the political specter of the term socialized medicine, and could that just derail this?
of the public plan? Well, the president has said that he wants a, quote, public plan to be an option under the health reform plan. And what that would mean was, is some kind of plan that's sponsored by the government, paid for by the taxpayers, that would be either a backup or one of the choices that individuals or employers or states could use to provide insurance. The White House says the best part of that is that it provides a check and a balance on the insurance industry. That if the insurance industry goes back to its old ways of skimming a lot of profit, providing inefficient care, and denying services, there's a taxpayer-sponsored public plan that'll keep them honest as competition. So that's why the White House wants it. Nobody's really defined what a public plan is. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like. And some of the speculation about why is the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry all of a sudden paying nice, you start to wonder, have they bought themselves a promise or a little bit of goodwill on what the public plan will look like?
Well,
the
White House last night said no. It's expensive goodwill in the sense that there's no real business model for a lot of preventive care if they're going to subsidize that. I guess the administration is really hoping that most of America sounds like Kendall from Morristown, New Jersey, who had this suggestion for health care.
We have to have a national health care system. We have to have Medicare for all. Health care should not be a profit-making industry, and that's where most of the money goes. It goes to administration. It goes to so-called managed care, and that's what's costing so much.
So, Todd, give us the last word in the last couple of seconds. We've got to get to Femi here.
We're not going to get national health care in the sense that he wants, but I do know this. The United States spends twice as much as any other country, and we have worse outcomes. So we need to look at where our money is going and what we're getting for it, and that's what a lot of the debate hopefully will
and
be about this
the
summer.
Debate begins at 12:30 when the president speaks to the nation about this cost savings plan, $2 trillion over 10 years. We shall see. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Thank you, as always, Todd.
My pleasure.
For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
And go, go, Femi Okay with the headlines.
At 28 minutes past the hour, the American-Iranian journalist Roxana Saberi has been freed from Iranian jail today. Saberi's lawyer says the court reduced her 8-year prison sentence to a suspended 2-year sentence. Saberi was convicted of spying for the U.S. in April, but denies the charge. President Obama's top national security adviser says that the U.S. will likely keep launching airstrikes against extremists in Afghanistan. That's after a coalition force air raid in western Afghanistan was blamed for dozens of civilian deaths last week. Fire officials say that a California wildfire that's burned through 13 square miles was probably started by sparks from a power tool used to clear brush. Some residents of Santa Barbara County had received an annual notice advising them to clear the hazardous brush, and that fire has now destroyed 77 homes. Let's look at top stories making news this morning for I.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning, everyone.
Hey, I'm Farai Chidea. Okay, $2 trillion in healthcare savings. That sounds amazing. The industry voluntarily delivering it. That sounds amazing, too. That's the plan over the next 10 years. We want to know, what's your plan? How would you bring down the cost of healthcare? We've got an email from Grace who says, eliminate all health insurance companies. Put their employees to work in new green industries. Pull down the environmentally wasteful and ugly steel and glass towers. Expand Medicare to us all. We will instantly cut healthcare costs by 25%. That's her plan. And what's yours? 877-8-MY-TAKE. What is your plan to reduce health care costs? How would you do it if it was your choice? My take at thetakeaway.org. John?
I don't know if the math works out quite there, but that's a great suggestion from Grace. So we are here with Melissa Clark, food writer for The New York Times, to solve a problem for you, a problem every day that you're confronted with in the workplace, what to do about lunch. In these trying times when layoffs are looming, you don't want to be away from your desk, not for an hour, not for 15 minutes. And then there's the expense of lunch. A sandwich a day, it's more than 50 cents. $9, $10, $20 a day. You can't spend that on lunch. You've heard of al dente, right? You've heard of al fresco, right? Well, we want to talk about al desco, cuisine at your desk, ways of creatively and cost effectively bringing a new pizzazz to lunch right there at your desk, short of hanging a glucose IV and actually giving your nutrition that way. Melissa, thanks so much for coming in. And we actually gave you this idea and sent you off to sort of figure it out. What have you come up with?
Well, this was a really fun one for me because, I mean, I work from home, so my lunchtime is a whole other thing. But my husband obviously works out of the house, and he eats lunch at his desk every day. And so he enjoyed me trying out these different things on him. The first thing is I want everybody out there to go set up a little desk drawer pantry.
Okay, desk drawer pantry.
This
okay,
is what I like to call good. This my desk drawer pantry. Just take either a little box or clear off a part of your desk. And if you could stock a few condiments and pantry items, you can jazz up anything. You can jazz up stuff from your salad bar. You can jazz up stuff even from your work cafeteria, believe it or not.
And all this right, is so this is not preparing food. This is actually pizzazzing food
this
that
is
you get.
A few, if you just sprinkle a little bit of really good olive oil. Right. Just get the best olive oil that you can. Sprinkle it on those greens that you get either in a big bag and you keep in your fridge. In fact, I snooped around your fridge here and I noticed that somebody had a big bag of greens. Perfect. You've got your bag of greens or your greens from the salad bar. Good olive oil will taste so much better than the dressing that they have on the side there. Good salt. Go and get good coarse sea salt. If you want to splurge, you can use fleur de sel, or if you don't want to splurge, kosher salt. It's all going to be better than the stuff in the packets.
And cheaper.
Next thing, red wine vinegar. Good red wine vinegar. Again, you've got your salad dressing. Red wine vinegar is also amazing on your sandwiches. You know, if you just get a tuna sandwich from the deli, just a few drops of red wine vinegar, or check this one out, sesame oil it's just going to change the flavor profile. You keep it at your desk. Good mustard. You do not need to refrigerate mustard. Everyone thinks you do. You don't. Keep your Dijon at your desk. Smear it on everything. It's going to taste better than the stuff in the packets. And then the most important thing is freshly ground black pepper. Get a pepper grinder and keep it at your desk. Label it with your name on it so nobody steals it, you know. And these are the things that are going to make a huge difference to whatever you get.
Well, you know, just quickly, it's funny that you mentioned that Dijon doesn't have to be refrigerated because there is food theft in many
yes.
offices. We won't call anyone out, NPR West. But what do you do about that?
I know. You know, it's funny. As I was snooping in your fridge over there, I noticed that everybody had their food neatly labeled with their name and the date. And I say, that's exactly the best way to do it is just take your tape. Tape it around the package, not just on top, but actually tape it closed. Because I think that if someone is thieving, they'll feel a little bit more of a pang if they actually have to undo the tape that you've elaborately taped.
Well, there's actually motion sensor technology. And that's really a question. I mean, there are tools. You're talking about upgrading food that you probably got from around the corner. But you can actually prepare whole meals at your desk with some certain raw materials, and short of like bouillabaisse, which probably isn't recommended there at your desk.
Although if you buy I bet you there's freeze-dried bouillabaisse out there somewhere. Just add water, you know, boiling water.
So can you have a boiling appliance at your desk that's appropriate? A toaster oven is maybe a little too elaborate.
That might be a little too much. But what about a kettle? What about an electric kettle? First of all, most offices you probably have somewhere to make tea, right?
Right.
So just use that boiling water. Use that hot water. There's probably a microwave. And all supermarkets have a sort of instant food section. I went to Trader Joe's and I had a great time. I just bought all their stuff.
And that's what you brought.
And that's
in
what
here.
I brought
this
you.
What is this called?
This is called Punjab Choli. And so it's a Punjabi dish, so from, you know, Pakistan, northern India. Mm-hmm. You can taste how spicy it is. Sorry, it's a little bit spicy for breakfast there.
That's all right.
But what I did was I put chopped fresh spinach in it. And as I was heating it up, you don't even need to chop it. Just fresh spinach straight from the salad bar or from a big bag that you buy. And if you add something green and fresh to even your udon noodles, your ramen noodles, whatever you have that you're heating up in the microwave at work, add something fresh and green. It's going to make doesn't that taste good?
That's just fantastic. So think of your prepared food as a raw material.
Exactly. And then you're just doing, all you're doing is basically heat eat, and then think of the green as the garnish. You could use scallion. Here's another tip. Always have a sharp knife at your desk. Buy an avocado, a tomato, a zucchini, and cut it up and eat it alongside. It's going to make your lunch so much fresher tasting.
But in a tense work environment, sharp knives, is that a good idea?
No,
I don't know if they're going to put it in. Well, we want your recipes, actually, if you have some great Al Desco ideas, call us at 877-8-MYTAKE or post them on our website at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Any other sort of suggestions?
Yeah, here's a good one. As you see, I put your food on a placemat over there.
Right.
Center for Disease Control says, if you're going to eat lunch at your desk, put a placemat down because your desk is full of bacteria and you don't want it in your lunch. So, and I think personally, it adds that little special ambiance.
It makes you feel civilized.
It does.
Yes, it does. It's a creature comfort. It's do something for yourself moment.
And it's like this is lunchtime, not work time. And also, don't email and eat lunch. Just eat your lunch. Focus on it. Enjoy it. And bring a real fork. It also is so much more pleasant than a plastic fork.
And they also say you'll eat less if you eat and don't type.
Exactly. Mindful eating, very important. Good tip.
Lots of good tips. That's why it's so great to have Melissa Clark in the studio with us. Melissa Clark, food writer for the New York Times, and she was here talking about Al Desco strategies for real cuisine prepared at your desk. And now Femi Oke has some lunch for us. No, you have headlines for us.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting this news in. The U.S. military says that five U.S. soldiers were killed in a shooting at an American airbase in Baghdad. American-Iranian journalist Roxana Saberi has been freed from Iranian jail today. Saberi's lawyer says the court reduced her 8-year prison sentence to a suspended 2-year sentence. Her father, Reza Saberi, speaking to reporters earlier today, says he's making preparations for the entire family to leave Iran. Saberi was convicted of spying for the U.S. in April, but she denies the charge. In Sri Lanka, a government doctor says that at least 430 ethnic Tamil civilians are dead after 2 days of shelling across the northern war zone there. 50,000 civilians are thought to be trapped with Tamil tigers in the war zone, which is about the size of New York's Central Park. And the claims are really difficult to verify because reporters are banned from the war zone. Back on the Hill, the president takes on healthcare again today. He plans to announce an offer from the private sector to spend $2 trillion to help pay for his healthcare overhaul. And also today, the Justice Department is expected to restore an aggressive antitrust enforcement policy. And this would reverse the Bush administration's approach, which strongly favored businesses in antitrust suits. That's a look at headlines making news today.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea.
Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up.
Now, those are the opening lines of The Story of Stuff. It's a web video that's popping up in classrooms across the country. It focuses on environmental effects of consumer culture. It uses really simple language and these really cute line drawings, but it's controversial. Some parents and teachers say it's biased and anti-capitalist, but some others have embraced it. So right now we have Leslie Kaufman of the New York Times, who's followed The Story of Stuff. Leslie, let's jump right into it. So why is this so popular?
I think teachers were looking for a way to talk to kids about their cell phones and their blue jeans, where they came from and what happened to them after they went away. And this provided a really easy to understand vehicle for that. 20 minutes right to the point, very easy to see and watch and hear.
Well, you know, this continues to really talk about the environmental impact that even kids have on the world.
In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here.
You know, it struck me that in your story that you wrote about this, there's a kid who ponders whether or not he should buy Legos because they're not really going to decompose very naturally. And he ultimately says, I'll just keep them for a long time. That kind of conscious decision making is something that definitely parents love in children. Are parents helping to push this too?
I think so. I think that there are parents who love this video and have shown it to their kids and shown it to each other. Of course, there are also parents who don't like a message which speaks roughly of capitalism, which they support.
Tell us a little bit more about the critique of this as anti-capitalist.
It is. It's very tough. Capitalist system, maybe for good reasons, maybe not for good reasons. It sees corporations as particularly powerful, and it thinks that corporations have an incentive to have us cut things down and throw things away even when we don't need to. It talks a lot about advertising and television, and those are messages that can resonate both ways with families. Some people find them to be a personal to take, and some people see it as a truth that we have to hear.
All right. Well, Leslie, thank you so much. That's Leslie Kaufman of the New York Times. Now we've got John Line, a BBC Tehran correspondent. The AP is now saying that Iranian-American journalist Roxana Sabiri has been released from an Iranian prison today. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we understand she has been freed. I'm outside of Evin prison now. Nobody's actually seen Roxana Sabiri leave the prison. However, her lawyer came out to say that she'd been freed, and all the journalists now left, so we obviously trust that that is true. We believe she's headed off to her apartment, which is in another part of Tehran, and the good news is that Roxana Sabiri is free. She's been released after her sentence was reduced from 8 years in prison to 2-year suspended sentence so that she doesn't have to serve that immediately. She can go. She's free to go. She's free to leave the country, according to her lawyer. And the actual charge has been reduced from one of passing information on to a hostile power just to having access to classified information.
Well, John, thank you so much for the update. John Line, BBC Tehran correspondent.
A lot of implications there for U.S.-Iranian relations. Obama had called for her to be released.
Absolutely.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we have been asking how you would start to bring down the cost of health care in light of the fact that the president is announcing $2 trillion in health care savings, voluntary health care savings, by the industry. Now, look at your own budget. How would you bring down costs? Florence has this suggestion.
Each person should become responsible for their own health care, particularly diabetic patients who know that they should control their weight and their diet, and then visit doctors every week for some kind of enhanced health care.
Well, weight has come up again and again in our conversations, and it's certainly a huge issue in America. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Let us know how you would cut down costs, or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Femi, you got the headlines.
Thank you. At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, Iranian-American journalist Roxana Sabiri has been released from an Iranian prison. Her father, Reza Sabiri, has been talking to reporters.
We were expecting some break in the case, but we are not completely surprised, but we are happy to hear that.
Sabiri's sentence was suspended in a decision by an Iranian appeals court, and Sabiri had been convicted on charges of espionage, which the U.S. government said were untrue. Pope Benedict is in Israel today. He was met by the airport by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Right after his arrival, he called for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Back in the United States, the White House says that the federal budget deficit is expected to get even worse. It's projected to rise above $1.8 trillion. That's about 4 times the record set just last year. And the extra red ink comes from the cost of the Wall Street bailout and the economic stimulus plan. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So if George W. Bush's quagmire was Iraq, perhaps Afghanistan will be the quagmire for Barack Obama. What am I talking about? Well, look at the pages of history. 20 years ago, the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan. It had spent a decade in that nation after its invasion. And in Afghanistan today, NATO forces are fighting a battle with an insurgency. The question for the United States is, are the themes of the Soviet experience in Afghanistan being repeated now? Joining us are three people to pose this question to. Sergei Khrushchev is the son of the former Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, and is currently a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University in Rhode Island. So, Russian lessons for the situation in Afghanistan. Sergei Khrushchev, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joining us are James Joyner of the Atlantic Council from Washington, D.C., who's an expert on this subject. James Joyner, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from London, our partners at the BBC, Alexei Solohubenko is the BBC Europe editor. Alexei, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Sergei, I begin with you. The son of Nikita Khrushchev, you observed firsthand the situation of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Is history repeating itself today?
Yes, I think that history is repeating itself, not starting from the Soviet involvement in the fighting in Afghanistan, but we go deeper in the history when Russian Empire and British Empire decided it was dangerous to fight there, because it is very different culture, it is very different people, they are not organized. And when we are fighting there, what we are fighting for, what is our goal, what does it mean, the victory? Because they want to live under their rules, and they don't want to live under our rules. And we have this illusion that we can win. I know it is still a Russian general saying, if we will have another year and another 10 or 20,000 people, we would win. I think now it's a little bit different, because at Soviet time, behind Taliban, it was unlimited American resources. Now they're limited. It is possible to crush them. But what will be after that?
Well, is it in the interest of the world community, before we let you go, Sergei, that Afghanistan is stable under any regime?
I think it's in the interest of the world community. It was what my father told at that time when he tried to make a best relations with the Afghan king, and we had very good relations. Afghan monarchy was the good friend of the communist Soviet Union.
And in fact, most of the infrastructure that even exists today in Afghanistan is Soviet built to this day. Sergei Khrushchev, thanks so much for being with us.
Because my father told that better to have this stable country on our borders than fortify your own borders.
All right. Well, thank you, Sergei Khrushchev, a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown. The question is how to get to that stable government, that good relationship that Nikita Khrushchev had with the king of Afghanistan. James Joyner and Alexei Solohubenko, what are the common themes of the U.S. and NATO and Soviet experience in Afghanistan, and what are the different themes? James, we'll begin with you.
Well, I think that Mr. Khrushchev is right that the main commonality is the lack of a very clear exit strategy in terms of what is the overall goal. The other similarity that many have pointed to is the problems caused by the use of air power, using bombing to attack the militants invariably kills a large number of innocents and makes the so-called winning hearts and minds business very, very difficult.
Well, in fact, that theme was actually explicitly addressed by Zamir Kabulov, who is the Russian ambassador to Afghanistan, a year ago. Listen to this.
There is no mistake left that had been made by Soviet Union that was not repeated by international community here in Afghanistan. Underestimation of Afghan nation, belief that we have superiority over Afghans, and that they're inferior and they cannot be trusted to run affairs.
Alexei Solohubenko in London, is NATO underestimating Afghan, either culturally or militarily or politically?
I think it has certainly heightened the expectations of what is achievable, because I think this is a common thread that runs through the Soviet approach to engagement in Afghanistan. The whole idea of intervention resulting in some kind of different outcome, that the country will be different, the governance will be different, the system of tribal relations will be changed, was really not read through either by the Soviets, in my view, or by some of the NATO strategies. But also there's a perceived threat. In the case of NATO, there's a threat of terrorism and the threat of drugs, you know, spilling out of Afghanistan. In the case of the Soviet Union 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, rather, it was the perceived threat of Muslim influences in Central Asia and destabilization of the whole area that was such a soft underbelly of the Soviet Union and was and is still quite dangerous and volatile.
James Joyner, it seems to me that while the argument often is that the scale of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan is huge compared to the scale of the NATO and troops on the ground in Afghanistan, that still doesn't prevent it from being just as much of a quagmire. Do you agree with that?
Oh, indeed. I mean, in fact, I would say the opposite is almost true. I mean, part of the reason, you know, given what seems to be a very ambitious goal, or at least an early ambitious goal of democratizing and you know, westernizing Afghanistan, having fewer troops makes that much more difficult. It's easier in terms of you have fewer targets and you have less of a footprint. But you know, Afghanistan's a very big place, and it's very difficult to operate a counterinsurgency mission or even a stability operation with, you know, a relatively small force that we've got.
And we're going to have 60,000 troops, or NATO will have 60,000 troops in the country by the fall. That's up from 38,000 now. Last word from Alexei Solovhubenko in London.
Well, I thought, you know, those troops, what are they for? Are they for constructive engagement, or are they for a robust containment of what is Afghanistan? I think before this question is answered, it's very, very difficult to see how the mistakes that were made by the Soviet Union 20 years ago would not be repeated again.
History repeating itself, an issue for the Obama administration as we think about the security situation in Afghanistan. Alexei Solovhubenko, the Europe editor of our partners, the BBC, thanks for beginning that discussion. And Alexei joined us from London, along with James Joyner of the Atlantic Council, who joined us from Washington, D.C. Thanks to you both. Farai?
Well, we've been talking about health care costs today in anticipation of President Obama saying that voluntarily the health care industry is going to cut $2 trillion. The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick had this to say.
Nobody's really defined what a public plan is. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like. And some of the speculation about why is the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry all of a sudden paying nice, you start to wonder, have they bought themselves a promise or a little bit of goodwill on what the public plan will look like?
And here's what you had to say.
If you want to really save money on health care, you need to run a nonprofit insurance company. Our present insurance companies take out 14% profit. Medicare takes out zero profit. There's the problem.
Nonprofit healthcare system, one of the many suggestions from you for how to bring down healthcare costs. You can hear the rest of those comments and add your own at thetakeaway.org. And you can also follow Todd Zwillick on Twitter. You can find the Zwillick Twitter feed at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.